All right, welcome everyone to the final session of the 2017 year of Football Scholars Forum. We're now about to start our eighth year, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Anthony Clavain to the forum to discuss his book, Promised Land, A Northern Love Story, which won the British Sports Book of the Year Award in 2011. He's written at least two books that I know of that we chatted about earlier since then, and both related to football in different ways. And maybe Anthony can share some information about those two books, part of this kind of trilogy. And when I saw this book, I was kind of embarrassed that I hadn't come across Promised Land sooner, since it has been published for a while. And what caught my eye really was its ability to bridge the worlds of journalism and history so effectively through football, and that it does it in a way that would appeal to many of us here in the Football Scholars Forum. So I contacted Anthony after reading it this summer, and he was very gracious to join us, and eager to talk about the book and also some of the key issues raised in the book, whether it's, you know, the art of the memoir or social history or the footballogy that's embedded in it, including that very interesting contemporary analysis that he does towards the end of the book that I understand fed into the Yorkshire Tragedy book, his most recent one. So without further ado, why don't we turn it over to our author, Anthony Clavain, who will speak for a few minutes, and then we'll open up the field for the Q&A. Over to you, Anthony.
Thank you very much, Peter. I feel very flattered that you're sort of discussing the book, a book which I've been wanting to write for a long time, and I finally got round to writing it in about 2009. So it kind of, although, you know, almost 10 years ago, it kind of resonates now with me even more, because as we speak, I'm still in the same position I think I was in back in 2009, in that I was feeling very, very sort of depressed about my football club. So this is not an uncommon thing. you feel happy when they win, you feel sad when they lose. But it was deeper than a sort of sadness. It was just a sort of feeling that, and I think this is where you're talking about memoir and history. It was just a feeling that, you know, in middle age, that a sort of a better age had passed. That kind of slightly romantic view, I know, but a sort of golden age when where there was a sort of perfect storm for me of community, belonging, identity. And those three things, community, belonging, identity, were sort of evoked through my love for a football team. And those three things, community, identity, and belonging, they seem to be disappearing. And it wasn't just that my football team was really bad and had been relegated and had been in the lower leagues, although it was an unusual thing for a team of the status of Leeds United to actually plunge into the third tier of English football. It's not, you know, you don't get Barcelona or Liverpool, Bayern Munich doing that. And I just thought, rather than a question of bad luck or bad managers, bad decisions, terrible refereeing decisions, which of course have been a lot against Leeds, very biased referees over the years. But apart from all the usual things that you associate with your team being in a bad place, I just thought it was a wider issue for me about the place of my own community in Leeds, which was in a sort of immigrant Jewish community that had been strongly attached to the club. The city of Leeds, which had been suffering for many years, I think really particularly since the 1980s and the rise of a sort of brand of neoliberalism that I think had infected this country. And it was also a sense that football itself was no longer the game that I knew, in which the fans, the supporters, the players, the managers, they all seem to be bound together in one community. There seemed to be a disconnect between football and the wider community, whether it be for a village, a town, or a city. And I think that through football, I wanted to explore these issues. A very personal issue for me, of course, being how my grandparents had come to Britain and had attached themselves to sport. And I thought that was interesting. But I thought now, that my generation and my children's generation, we were losing that attachment. And it felt to me part of a wider disengagement that, the bond that we had with our football club, with our city, even with our religious community, that bond was breaking. And the breaking of that bond seemed to me to mark a moment when I wanted to, in a kind of elegiac kind of way, reflect on possibly the last 100 years of football, of a city which is basically 700,000, strong. It's a really big city, but also of an immigrant community, and try and bring those three things together in a way that I don't think had been done before. I was told I was being overambitious. I was told by my publisher at the time, not to get carried away with the Jewish side of it and with the lead side of it, but to concentrate on football. But to some extent, I ignored the advice, and I tried to give equal weight to all three things and to try and bring them together. At the time, it seemed to me that, particularly after The Damned United, which was a very brilliant novel by David Peace, had sort of struck a chord with a lot of people. It was about Leeds and Leeds United. There seemed to be this appetite for not just, looking at football in a very, obvious, superficial way, who was winning trophies, who was being relegated, who was buying players. But there seemed to be, a moment when people were starting to write about the bigger picture, the social, cultural, political, economic, intellectual sort of underpinnings of football. And I think this was a kind of a moment when, I felt really inspired to write this book.
That's great. Thank you, Anthony. Any particular inspirational models for the authors that inspired you? I mean, we were talking earlier about Nick Hornby and Fever Pitch, which came out in, 91 or 92. Was that one of them, or were there other books in particular or authors that moved you?
There were three very particular influences on me. First of all, Nick Hornby. Fever Pitch. Second of all, David Peace, Damned United. And thirdly, there was a book by Howard Jacobson, which was called Kaluki Nights. Now, this is a novel written about growing up as a sort of working class Jew in Manchester in the 1950s. And all three influenced me. Hornby, without a doubt, was a great pioneer. And his book, which came out in the early 90s, he sort of looked at football. He looked at the emotional life of being a football fan. But he also touched on, sociological themes and cultural themes. I mean, the idea that, he was an Arsenal fan. But for him, when he looked back on his, his love life, he would, for example, remember breaking up with his first girlfriend because it was a wet, cold, wet night in Coventry when Arsenal had drawn 1-1, and Liam Brady had managed to get an equaliser. This is how he managed to think back on all the big moments in his life. And it was very funny, but it was very poignant. And he also went beyond that to look at the sort of culture of how a team like Arsenal came to be supported by someone like himself, who did not live in North London. And it was connected very much to his father taking to the match and the father-son relationship. It was also a sense that he wanted to get away from his small town. I think it was Maidenhead that he lived in. And he wanted to identify with quite a cool place, but also a place which, you know, had a lot of cultural kudos. But at the same time, I think it was, you know, in many ways very influential, because people started to talk confessionally about football. It suddenly became a fashion for people to bring in, for football fans to bring in their personal lives, and not just say that they were proud of their team, that they were, you know, over the moon about winning. It was a deeper issue now, football, and suddenly a new generation had emerged, and it became acceptable not to treat football as a I thought quite, you know, dismissively really, as sort of an aspect of popular culture that really was not fit to be discussed alongside other great forms of popular culture, where it might be the Beatles music, or it might be the films of Martin Scorsese. Those areas were very ripe for discussion, but football had always been dismissed, perhaps because of its working class origins in this country, anyway, in Britain, and also sport as a whole in the country that I live in Britain, had not been treated with the respect and the reverence that perhaps a sport, I don't know, let's take in the United States of America, had been treated. It wasn't treated as seriously. Before Hornby, you know, you had Philip Roth, for example, writing, you know, State of the Nation novels about America's sort of infatuation, with baseball. And also, by the way, seeing that as a way of a Jewish immigrant community integrating into society. So I think this was the early 90s, was Fever Pitch was the beginning of this new writing about football. Secondly, David Peace's book Damned United is in my view one of the best, you know, novels ever written about football. It's an extraordinary novel. I mean, you know, it's very hard to describe or define, but that was a huge influence, in part because it actually dealt with the myth or the mythology of Leeds United. And finally, this novel, which you might or might not have heard of, by Howard Jacobson, who is kind of like the Philip Roth of in Britain, which was a very funny, painful memoir, a fictionalization anyway, of growing up in a big northern city in England, Manchester. And the big northern city in England I grew up in, Leeds, had a similar narrative to that.
Would anyone out there in our international group want to ask the next question, perhaps? The issue of the stadium, did a hand go up? Yes, I see Chris's hand went up. Okay, Chris, over to you. Chris Boltzmann in California.
Hello, Anthony, and thank you very much for a fantastic book. I read it a while ago. And being a South African, obviously my question is about the South African connection to Leeds, going back to Jerry Francis in the late 50s, and of course Albert Johannesson, and I appreciate that those two players were before your time, but then of course Lucas Radebe and Phil Masinga, and then more recently David Soma. Can you maybe talk about the influence of the first four players that I mentioned, because of course all being black players, and the significance of football in South Africa is obviously clear to everybody, but maybe just talk about that South African connection, particularly in relation to the contradictions you alluded to around this, the right wing element that Leeds has has attracted, I would say, I mean, I say this cautiously and tentatively. If you could possibly just address some of those issues.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, first of all. I feel very flattered that you think that I'm too young not to have remembered Albert Johannessen and Jerry Francis. In fact, I grew up at my first match was 1966 when I was 6 years old, and Albert Johannessen was actually playing for Leeds. But he was a great hero to me and to my friends. And what was extraordinary about Albert Johannessen, who was one of the most skillful players I've ever watched in my life, and you know, if I was to wear my hat as a football journalist, and I've been one for 20 years, I've watched all the great players. I've watched, Maradona, Johan Cruyff, actually, going back to the 1970s. And in recent years, the likes of Messi, Ronaldo, and David Batty, of course. No, but that's actually a joke. He isn't part of that great canon. But anyway, I have watched some of the greatest footballers ever, and Albert Johannessen was up there with them. And the amazing thing is that he lived very close to me in Leeds. And I was, as I say, I grew up in the Jewish community in Leeds. And you could actually see Albert towards the end of his life, which was a very sad, kind of tragic end to his life anyway. You could see him occasionally. And he was the friend of my friend's father, who was a lawyer. And Albert, at one point when he had this horrible descent into alcoholism, he was worried that he would end up selling his football medals, pawning them, so to fund his drinking, and he brought his medals around to the father of my friend and said to him, could you put them in the safe and lock them and never, even if I ask, never give them to me. So that was my memory of Albert. He was absolutely loved by the Leeds United fans, and as you've just said, there was a contradiction here. So I think the sort of narrative about Leeds United is that over the years it's been called Dirty Leeds for a reason, not just simply because of the alleged style of play that the manager Don Revie brought in, which certainly put sort of physicality and gamesmanship at times before the attractiveness or the aesthetic beauty of football. It was also because there was a sort of brutality to the city. There's this darkness to the city, and there's a sort of racist element that has always been there. And this is not particularly unique to Leeds. I mean, it sort of exists and has existed throughout football, and yet Leeds has been associated with that over the years. They had a big far-right presence when I was growing up, and some terrible racist sort of chanting in the crowds. The far-right organization, the National Front, sold its magazine Bulldog out the football ground, and a lot of people have seen Leeds really as epitomizing a kind of intolerance, and certainly at best a lack of welcoming towards outsiders. And yet here you have Albert Johannessen being revered by the Leeds fans. If you've ever seen the video of when the 1965 FA Cup final team, which lost to Liverpool, comes back to Leeds, 100,000 people outside, possibly 200,000 outside the town hall. The player that they're chanting for is not Billy Bremner or Jack Charlton, it's Albert Johannessen, and you can hear the crowd chanting, Albert, Albert. And this is interesting because Radebe, who's still very, very much loved in Leeds, and we're sort of now jumping into the 1990s, is equally loved. So I find it's not that easy to explain how the likes of Albert Johannesson and Lucas Radebe have actually become sort of almost deified by the Leeds fans. And yet, at the same time, there is this reputation for racism amongst a section of them.
Daniel, question from you.
Yeah, hi. My question is, the book is from 2010, I believe. So if you would write it today, what would be, additional issues you would raise? I mean, I don't know, maybe the ownership issue, for example. Chris, who asked on South Africa, because it's his personal interest, since I spent parts of this year to write a paper on rugby league, and Leeds is one of the strongholds of rugby league. How is the relation from like Leeds United to the rugby league clubs? Are the fan bases completely different, or are, maybe you could elaborate this a little bit?
Thank you. Yeah. Two very, very good questions. So where do I even begin when I say when you want me to talk about what's happened since 2010? So, you know, we've had another 7 or 8 years of misery, and I mean, I think that the idea of the book is really of a team, a city, a kind of a huge institution in this country and around the world, really, because a lot of people knew about Leeds United. But all these things, a city, a club, an institution that has fallen from grace. Now, that was my theme in 2010. And if we'd fallen from grace in 2010, my God, you know, we've fallen even further apart from a brief sort of good period where we got promoted from the third division to the second division. And one time when we beat Manchester United in the FA Cup, that's about it. And what have been the themes? Well, you know, doing a Leeds was seen, when I wrote the book, doing a Leeds was seen as this kind of madness that came when Peter Ridsdale was the owner, which was basically spending in a reckless way and then crashing and burning, because you'd overspent, and what had happened was that we became synonymous with clubs that were sort of flying high, but with very little sort of solid foundation behind it. And the big crash that came for Leeds, it was like the financial crash, you know, of 2007-2008. It was a big shock to the system, and it brought in a bit of a sea change. But it also brought in a whole raft of new owners to Leeds. And this has now highlighted a kind of craziness about English football, that since 2008, 2009, Leeds have had a succession of owners. And just when you think it couldn't get any worse, it got worse. So, for example, we had, and I have to be careful what I say, because some of these people are kind of litigious. But let's just put it this way. We've been unlucky with owners. We've had Ken Bates, and we then had I think in a way the only kind of Arab consortium without any money came to take Leeds over. And then we had an Italian known as called Massimo Cellino, who had so many different eccentric, put it mildly, habits that it's impossible to go through and list. But if you look at it in terms of a general theme, I think Leeds United have suffered the indignity of a series of bad owners, and you know, who knows where it's going now. But all I'll say is that bad ownership has meant that Leeds have had something like 9 different managers, whereas there was a time, you know, when in the book that I write, that Don Revie, for example, was the manager from 1960 1972 to 1974, and they had one manager for 12 years. You know, then they also had a great period under Howard Wilkinson. He was manager, you know, for something like 8 years. David O'Leary, there was a great run under David O'Leary. He was there for 5 years. There's no coincidence that when we had one manager running the club and trying to reinvent the club, all those three reinventions, we were most successful. We won trophies. We finished in the top four or five. We won the league. We did well in Europe. We got to the semi-final of the Champions League. But when we've had managers who are coming and going because of, you know, the owners, because of a number of factors, then the instability has plunged Leeds further and further into the abyss. So I'm very pessimistic at the moment. I mean, I feel that each week, you know, you can't really tell what's going to happen. But the bigger picture is that ever since that crash that took place under Peter Ridsdale and the board that sort of overspent, Leeds have been sort of going downhill. Occasionally, there'll be a good run. But on the whole, it's not been a good picture. And what's the second point is your rugby league question. Leeds used to be a rugby league city. And this is very important to know. Rugby league is a wonderful sport, but it tends to be confined to the north of England and certain parts of the north of England, such as South Yorkshire, some of West Yorkshire and South Lancashire. And Leeds United found it very difficult to compete with this in the first 60 years of their existence. But when football grew in the 1960s and Don Revie took over, it became the big sport in the city. But football over the last 20 or 30 years has been in decline to the extent that rugby league and the team Leeds Rhinos have I think, had a better connection with the community in Leeds than the football club. They don't get the big crowds that the football club have, but they've been far more successful. And they've also brought through, and this is a crucial point for me, and I'd like to discuss this actually, they've brought through a lot of home-produced rugby league players. They've come from Leeds or they've come from Yorkshire, and they've become very famous and very important figures. Whereas in the past, the Leeds United I remember in the 1960s and 70s, they had a lot of young homegrown players. But today, and this is very symptomatic of how football has become, you know, you'll find it very difficult to find players who've, you know, come from Leeds, who are homegrown, who are brought through. And if this is for the football, if they are, they are then sold. Leeds has a very good youth academy. It's produced a lot of young players over the years and in the last few years as well, but they've been sold. You can bring, you know, I can give you 11 great players who are playing at the moment in English football who've come from Leeds, but they don't play for Leeds United. You know, off the top of my head, you know, you're thinking of the likes of James Milner, Fabian Delph, Johnny Dowson, Charlie Taylor. You know, I could go on. But if you look at the rugby, they are producing, the rugby league that is, they are producing from the grassroots, bottom up, still lots of players. And that to me tells you all you want to know about how rugby league is connected to the community and how football has become disconnected to the community.
That's very, very interesting. I know virtually nothing about rugby, so why do you think this relationship between rugby and association football has changed so much over the years? And then we'll turn to Alex with a question.
I know I've talked probably too much so far, but can I answer in one word?
140 characters. No, just kidding.
Can I give you one word?
Please.
Money.
Anyone want to comment on that? Money conquers all.
It's conquered football, and in my view, it's been responsible for the sort of disengagement, the process that I've tried to talk about, the disengagement between the fans, you know, ordinary people, on the whole, tend to be working class people, the disengagement between them and their sporting team. This disengagement has been entirely down to money, to the way that the Premier League is now the richest league in the world. That you've basically got in football, in the Premier League, billionaires owning clubs that are managed by multimillionaires, with players who are all millionaires, and therefore it's not surprising, in my mind, that loyalty, community, connection to fans has all sort of...
This is Alex Galarza of the Football Scholars Forum. Apologies for cutting in, but we had the call interrupted by technical difficulty. We pick it back up when we were able to reconnect with the author and the group.
The meeting ID.
And Anthony, are you listening?
Yes, hello.
It's funny, I made a tweet. I checked whether my favorite club, Hannover 96, ever played against Leeds United. And they played in 68-69 in the what is called today Europa League against each other.
We won 2-1.
First match, Leeds won 5-1. First match, yeah. Leeds won 5-1. Second one, 2-1. But who scored the goal for Hannover? Did you see it?
Ah, no.
Jupp Heynckes.
Ah, really?
Really, well, yeah.
Yeah.
He played 3 years for Hannover. Hmm. Not everybody knows, but he played 3 years for Hannover.
Well, I didn't know that. This is, you know, Michael Caine used to say, not a lot of people know that. And that this is true.
Well, I have to proudly tell this, since I'm a Hannover fan, that Jupp Heynckes played 3 years.
Well, I have a vague memory of it, and I suspect that I imagine that Alan Clark and Peter Lorimer will have been scoring for Leeds in those games.
But you know, I know so well what you're talking about, because also Hannover, they went down to third league. I had 2 years a season ticket for third league during my PhD.
And in terms of the overall scheme of things, how much of a shock was it for Hannover to do this?
No, I think it was what happened is that since they played well in the third league, they had more fans than in the second league, and it was a revival of like community pride and bonding to the club. It was a good time. They closely missed as a promotion in the first league, but the second season they moved up, and it was not a bad time in Hannover's case.
I don't want to be misunderstood, because I think that there is still a very good, in fact, an excellent spirit in Leeds in terms of the fans, and like you say, the lower they went, the stronger the bond became, therefore I'm not trying to suggest that Leeds United fans aren't very loyal. They are, but at the same time they've been treated very badly, and this is not new. This is not different to a lot of other places, but I think they've been treated very badly by a succession of very bad owners. And in a city that is so big, you know, 700, in terms of the greater Leeds, 770 or 80,000, you know, in the city, it's a huge city with only one football club, and it's had a big role to play in the history of English football. It felt to me symptomatic of a wider sort of malaise that has taken place in football and in sport.
Brilliant. Okay, would anyone like to jump in? Perhaps any of the folks who haven't had the opportunity to ask a question yet? Alex, yes, sorry, that's who was next in the queue.
That's okay.
All right.
Sorry, everyone, for the hiccup.
Anthony, I wanted to ask you about the play and just if you could tell us about that experience and what it meant to have it adapted and how much it differentiated. Do you think there was a way that the play had the same message in a different way in the book, or do you think the medium itself was trying to tell a different story, maybe more about Leeds itself? I haven't seen it, obviously, so I've only read reviews.
Sure, but no, that's a great question, because the play was a play which involved 30 different actors and actresses from Leeds, and in a way, although, you know, the themes of the book were very clear in the play, and it was a reference to my own family and, you know, to a certain extent, myself and my journey, it was more important as a play that was by the people of Leeds, about the people of Leeds, for the people of Leeds. But very interestingly, people, you know, there's a big division between sort of sport and art, you know, which I don't like. To me, this is a false dichotomy. But when I was saying earlier about Nick Hornby, David Peace and so on, they showed that writing about football can be great art, you know. So I think the theatre as well is a fantastic vehicle, because when we think about football, what do we think about? We think about drama, we think about great stories, we think about conflict, we think about a very strong sense of identity, a very strong sense, as I said earlier, of belonging, community. So I don't see why the theatre and or art, if you like, and football or sport should not be connected. And what was interesting for me, the most interesting thing about the play, although it's a great sort of ego trip to see your own book adapted and people coming to watch the play, it was that a lot of people got involved or came to see the play who'd never seen a play before. And that was because they knew it was about Leeds United, and we had songs in the play that were Leeds songs that I'd helped to write, and they were seeing themselves in a way on stage. They were seeing their story on stage. They were seeing the good and the bad and the ugly. They were seeing the racism that we talked about before. They were seeing that kind of wonderful spirit that we talked about. They were seeing actual matches that were depicted, but they were seeing the story of Leeds. And if you see your story on the stage, you know, and it comes back to you, I think it's a very emotional sort of involvement. It's not going to watch, say, Shakespeare, which, however brilliant Shakespeare is, that, you know, they might sort of see a kind of a bit of a gap between. And therefore, I got a great kick out of the fact that it was being put on by a Leeds theatre company, and people were coming along and they were saying to me afterwards, they not only remembered, for example, references to Albert Johannessen, but they also were remembering, because I didn't shy away from the dark side, the sort of racism, and people who had been involved in that in the past came to me and said, you know, it brought it home to me. So it was the discussion afterwards, had a lot of interesting conversations afterwards. But I'll give one example. Two young women came to audition for the play. They didn't know they were coming to audition for a play, however. They saw an advert in the local newspaper which actually said, if you're interested in Leeds United, if you want to become involved in something to do with Leeds, come along. They came along. They were just fans. They'd never acted before in their lives. They told me afterwards they'd never been to the theatre before. They got two roles in the play and they loved it and it changed them. They said afterwards, you know, it was the first time they'd been to the theatre. Football and the theatre were connected to them, and that was as much of a joy as anything else. So apart from the themes which were very important, such as the rise and fall of a great city, the rise and fall of a great football club, the rise and sort of decline of my own Jewish community. When I say decline, I mean in terms of numbers. those themes were not just put to a very, you know, middle-class audience who are used to the theatre. Those themes were put to a lot of people who don't normally go to the theatre and don't normally see a connection between the theatre and football. And for that, I was very, very pleased to be part of the project.
Fantastic. Thank you. Martha has two questions from Berkeley, California.
Hi, can you hear me?
Hi, yes. Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay, so I enjoyed the book. I didn't quite get through the last few chapters, but skimmed through them quickly. But I enjoyed it. And one of the issues, and I think in later work you've taken directly on neoliberalism and all that, but I'm curious, to some extent, and you in the beginning you were even talking about in some ways how unlucky Leeds has been, whether it's in referee calls or bad owners or things like that. But so I'm wondering, and I'm also thinking about the other football clubs in Yorkshire in that area. How much of the problems of Leeds is a problem of the neoliberalism, the decline that it's been through, and also a northern problem or maybe a Yorkshire problem? Leeds situation relative to the other clubs in Yorkshire, or just Leeds itself?
Yeah. Well, that's a brilliant question, because it's if we just talk about Leeds and say, well, we've been unlucky, you can talk about any football club and say that. And I think every sort of supporter of any football club or sporting organisation can actually say, you know, there's a conspiracy against us. All the referees, they're out to get us. You know, all the authorities in football, they don't like us. And they can cite examples of this throughout their history. Every football fan tends to think this about their team. And I think that's the myth of Leeds, is that that's become part of our folklore. We're not the damned United, you know? We're not cursed. But thinking that we are is part of the problem. And I think that's part of the psychopathology of being a Leeds fan, or the Leedsness of, you know, it's a new word, I know, but the Leedsness is part of this problem. It's actually a lack of self-belief, and it contrasts with other northern clubs like Liverpool, Manchester United, Manchester City. So you asked that about how does it compare and contrast. So the first thing to say is, I think that Leeds has never, for various reasons that I go into in the book, has never had the same sort of self-belief that it's, you know, it's destined to be one of the great teams, even when it was actually one of the great teams. During the period when Leeds was most successful, they missed out on so many trophies, not through bad luck really, not because referees were biased, although they were, and two referees in two major European finals really became notorious for being, you know, it's hard to find the right words here because I have to be careful, but let's put it this way. After they refereed in the European Cup final and Cup Winners' Cup final, they weren't really seen again. But more importantly is the, as I say, the psychopathology of this, you know, very interesting city, a city of contradictions. And I think these contradictions go to the heart of maybe a Yorkshireness, which is maybe not a northerness, because you can come back at me and say, Liverpool, what about them? What about Manchester? There's something about Yorkshire, and I think it's to do a great deal with, you've said neoliberalism, but let me just preface my, you know, my remarks about neoliberalism by talking about the industrialization of Britain. That obviously the Industrial Revolution, we all know, began in Britain, began very early. It was part of the strength of Britain and the, you know, the beginnings of the empire. And it really began in Yorkshire, you know, and it began in places like Leeds and Sheffield, and Bradford and Barnsley and Rotherham and Doncaster. So and then smaller places that you may or may not have heard of, like Featherstone and Castleford and Wakefield. All these places, all these towns and cities where the steel industry began, the coal industry began, textiles, mills, and fishing industry as well. Let's not forget that in Hull and Grimsby and so on. But, well, Hull is the Yorkshire place. They were the foundations of the football teams and some rugby league teams that became so huge and so big. And in Leeds United's case, all conquering. And but earlier on, Sheffield United and Sheffield Wednesday, they were the, I mean, Sheffield, you know, the first ever modern football team was founded in Sheffield in 1857. And then there's a great tradition, I mean, take Huddersfield Town, you know, managed by Herbert Chapman. They won three leagues titles in a row. And there's a reason for that. And that's because these towns and these cities were booming because of the Industrial Revolution and the late 19th century, early 20th century. Their local economies were strong. Now, what happened in the 1980s was neoliberalism through the Margaret Thatcher governments of the 1980s. Neoliberalism was responsible for the destruction of the coal industry, the steel industry, textiles, and the mills, and so on. And therefore, these towns and these cities and these communities collapsed to the extent that their football teams and their rugby league teams, and to a certain extent their cricket teams, but let's stick with football, they themselves naturally suffered as a result of the loss of, let's just put it this way, in Barnsley, nearly all their players came from the local mines, the pits. And when those local mines and pits close down, where do your players come from? And then the fact that the miners are all out of jobs and the steelworkers are all out of jobs means they can't afford to go to football. So it's the economy stupid in many, many ways. Neoliberalism was introduced in the 1980s, and I write about it in my new book. It's called Moving the Goalposts, a Yorkshire Tragedy. And I argue that these places in Yorkshire which have been left behind by neoliberalism, such as Sheffield, Leeds, Doncaster, Bradford, Barnsley, and all the other places I mentioned, they've been left behind by globalization. They've been left behind by what has been in many ways a London-dominated economy, which the London rich London clubs like, say, Chelsea, Arsenal, Tottenham are now in the ascendant, whereas it used to be a very northern or a very Yorkshire thing. Yorkshire has a big hole where the industry used to be, and that hole is not being filled. It can't be filled by football, by rugby, by sport. It has to be filled by something more substantial to the local economy. And I think once the local economies revive in these places, and I hope that they do, but for the last 30 years they've suffered. Once there's a change in the local economy, I think therefore it's almost as simple as that. I think the teams in the areas that have suffered can start to be a good teams again, because I'll leave you with this. Apart from occasionally a team like Hull City or Huddersfield going up into the Premier League, mostly, the teams in Yorkshire have not been in the Premier League. They've been outside of the Premier League. And this is strange because Yorkshire has a population of 6 million people. How can you have a county which has a population of 6 million? It's slightly bigger than Scotland, you know, and Ireland. How can that have at times no representatives in the Premier League, or one representative? You know, where are Leeds United? Where are Sheffield United? Where are Sheffield Wednesday? They are not in the top flight, and they haven't been in the top league for many, many years, and it doesn't seem to me that they will be in the top league for many years.
That's really interesting. And I have another question, but I just was looking up also the Brexit votes, and Yorkshire voted to leave overall, but Leeds barely voted to stay, so to remain, but barely. So that's interesting.
My second question, can I? I think Brexit. I think you've just hit this to me. I'm almost obsessed with this. I'm a Remainer. You know, I think the decision to leave the European Union is one of the most irrational decisions in my lifetime. And yet, I spent 2 years traveling into the places which you have rightly called Brexit areas. I didn't know there were Brexit areas because it was before the EU vote, and I could sense that something odd was going on. And it was an oddness based on a sense that the communities, by becoming less cohesive and becoming fragmented and becoming disengaged from what they do call the elites of society. That's the political class, you know, the ruling elites in the economy, but also the ruling elites in football, the ruling elites in sport. I could sense that something was going on. The areas that I've mentioned voted to leave: Rotherham, Doncaster, Barnsley, Sheffield, which was once known as the Socialist Republic of Sheffield, by the way. Leeds very narrowly voted to stay, but it was something like, you know, 51-49%. It was or even smaller margin. So I wasn't surprised by this, and I think that as somebody who is a very strong Remainer, who in many ways thinks that this decision to leave was at worst, best odd, and at worst, an absolute and utter disaster for Britain, I have to listen. I have to understand why the working class communities in these dilapidated Yorkshire towns and cities, why are they turning to Brexit? And it's not dissimilar to the Rust Belt in America voting for Donald Trump, someone who I equally think operates on irrational principles and is a complete disaster. And yet his support seems to be holding firm, and the bombast of Donald Trump and the animus that he expresses towards people who are different, you know, to white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, that actually plays well with the core. Now, the support for Brexit is holding firm in these areas, in my opinion, and I regret that. But it's absolutely, you're completely right, it's absolutely connected to the fact that these towns, these cities have been left behind by neoliberalism, by globalization, and they've expressed themselves by sticking a middle finger up at the system. And in their football and rugby and cricket teams, a similar process has been going on.
So my second question, maybe this is brief, but I do note that there, at least since 1989, there's been a women's team, but the relationship with Leeds United has been back and forth and back and forth, and they've been independent several times, basically kicked out by the owners, and then I think just recently re-embraced. And I'm curious, it's probably a whole nother thing, but if there's any particular aspect that you've picked up on how the women are received within Leeds United.
Well, and again, a very good question, and it was hugely disappointing to see the way the women's team has been mistreated throughout the years. And as you say, there's been a sort of up and down situation there. I think that the last owner, the previous owner, Chelino, I remember not having a great attitude towards the women's team. But I think that one of the great positive things, and I've been a bit pessimistic in my assessment of football, so I can now strike a positive note. One of the great positives of English or British football in the last decade has been the growth of women's football. I actually went to see the England Lionesses, as they're called, the women's team, play the other day. It was a packed stadium in Colchester, you know, nearly 10,000 packed the stadium. And I think that this is, you know, in some ways the future perhaps lies with the women's game and with, as well, less mainstream parts of football, because the women's game has not been infected by the greed that I think that the men's game at the higher level has been infected. And I think people are turning to the women's game, not just in Leeds, but throughout the country, because it's a refreshing antidote to what has been, in many ways, a corrupting aspect of football. That they see in the women's game the spirit, the community, the identity, the loyalty, the values, but also the attractiveness of the football that they miss in the men's game at the elite level. So I think the growth of women's football, I've been quite sort of Eeyore-ish at the moment, and I know that I've been a kind of glass half full person, but I mean, sorry, glass half empty, but I'm a glass half full when it comes to the growth of the women's game. And I'm really hopeful that Leeds United, you know, women can actually, you know, at one point maybe they can approach, say, the Arsenal ladies, who I've watched their team a few times. They're a magnificent team and an institution in women's football. And I enjoy, just as I enjoy going to I also like to go to non-league games. You know, I like to go to lower division games. It feels more like the spirit of the football I remember in Leeds when I was a child, I was growing up. So, you know, maybe that's a positive that we can take out. Hello?
Yeah, thanks. I don't know who's...
Hi. Sorry, are we still... is everyone still there?
Yeah.
Yes.
But, yeah, and also, maybe to add to that, that there's no getting away from the fact that football in the past has been male-dominated, you know? And you know, it's important to say that football is becoming less male-dominated in many ways. And you know, I think that there are very positive steps to being taking place. I mean, to me, we're starting to see women who run the line. You know, women referees. I don't see why we can't have a woman being a coach, you know, of a big football team. These are the things, these are the breakthroughs that need to take place. And, you know, I suppose there was a sort of misogynistic attitude which existed in football. And to some extent, that's been eroded, I think, in the last decade.
I could jump in, I guess. I think maybe Peter's saying I'm next in line. I was curious. I wanted to follow up on a couple tangents from your previous comments. One is, and they're kind of different tangents, but I'll just mention them both, and you can take them how you like. One is you're mentioning a few times, and you say this at the beginning of the book too, that one of the things that's interesting about Leeds is the fact that there's just the one team for a relatively large area. So I was just curious a little more about that in relation to your initial point about kind of being interested in community and identity and belonging. I mean, it strikes me that you're making kind of a, you know, almost an empirical claim there, like that there would be more sense of community or belonging if there's just one team in an area that's of reasonably comparable size. And I'm sort of curious, like, is that, I don't know enough about the other comparable areas, I suppose, something like, would something like Sheffield or Liverpool or something be a comparison? And would you argue then that there's more sense of Leedsness because of the one team than there is of Liverpool-ness or Sheffield-ness or whatever, you know, whatever comparison was most appropriate. Yeah. And then in kind of a completely different piece that I was interested in was at the very, very end of the book when you talk about some of the contemporary stuff. And I'm always interested in the sort of development of players, and you kind of hit on this a little bit earlier when you were talking about Leeds developing a lot of players for other teams and the money piece, but I was interested in some of the demographics of it. You mentioned the South Asian Indian, South Asian population, and the fact that Leeds had a promising, at least one promising player that they were speculating was potentially going to be the first to play in the Premier League, but then didn't pan out. And I'm always curious about that. Again, being from a great distance, just the demographics, because in terms of support and in terms of interest, it seems like it's consistent across the demographic groups. But then in terms of ultimate representation on the teams and in the academies, it seems like it's disproportionate. So I was curious sort of how that's played out in the intervening time and whether you think there's anything particular about the Leeds situation or whether that's a sort of broader phenomenon in British football.
Well, I think I'll take your first point. So, you know, you mentioned Liverpool and Sheffield, and we could also say Manchester, but these are cities that are, yes, in a way of comparable size. You know, some people would argue, and this is strange, isn't it? But people can't quite make their minds up. You know, London is clearly the biggest city. Then it's Birmingham. Now, it's sort of disputed which is the third biggest city in England. Leeds likes to claim that. So does Manchester. I'm not, you know, it depends how you sort of look at the population. And also then we've got Liverpool, and Sheffield's a bit smaller. But it's interesting that Leeds is really, in terms of those kind of cities, it's the only one that has one club. I mean, the other thing to compare is with in the northeast, these great clubs like Newcastle, Sunderland, Middlesbrough, they all have one club, you know, in their cities. And there are also clubs that are in decline, by the way, and their past glories are just like Leeds, often referred to. But I think what I'm trying to say is, in a way, I think Leeds, like Newcastle, Sunderland, Middlesbrough, these one-club cities, we're living in the past. We're talking about our past glories, whereas you know, the likes of Liverpool and Manchester, they've moved forward. They've managed to come to terms with you know, what you might call the contradictions of 21st century globalization, and Leeds and other cities have not. So I think this goes back to why, in the first place, was a city like Leeds only, you know, such a big city, only possessing one football club? And that's because the other club in Leeds was the Rugby League Club. Now, the Rugby League Club is not known throughout the world. As I said, it's a fantastic sport, but it's geographically limited compared to football. And so most of the people on, you know, in this conversation tonight, it's this afternoon, I'm sure, for most of you, but for me, it's tonight. Most of the people involved will not really be knowing what I'm talking about when I talk about rugby league. But the psychopathology of rugby league is very much about, we don't particularly want to be internationally famous. You know, we don't care that we are a game that really, you know, it's mostly northern cities that play, or towns that play. We are happy to play in our own areas. We're not after that kind of recognition from the world. And they are, you know, we've just had a World Cup, which has been wonderful. I don't know if anyone knows that there's been the Rugby League World Cup. England lost to Australia in the final. It wasn't really covered. And that's a symptom of something, which is, rugby league is a very, you know, compared to football, it's a parochial game, and it's a working class game, and its origins are almost like in a working class rebellion that took place in the late 19th century. When Leeds, as a huge city, is a rugby league city, this is before Leeds United in the 1960s under Don Revie start to do well, it's the main sport in the city. That is a symptom of that city not really wanting to be internationally ambitious, not really wanting to have its place on the map, being content with its insularity. So to some people, this, and this is not my view, this would be symptomatic of a lack of ambition. Whereas I would argue, therefore, that Liverpool and Manchester are, and I suppose we should sort of call it how we see it, I think they are more aspirational, and they have been historically more ambitious cities. And I think this is both a good and bad thing. There's sometimes, if you are too ambitious and too aspirational, and you lose a connection with your identity. And the worry in Leeds and parts of Yorkshire is our identity is being eroded. You know, we've lost our the industry that defined our identity for 100-150 years. So what else should define our identity? Well, our local sporting teams. And therefore, I can understand why there is this need to sort of cling to that. There's a worry that if you take this big leap, say if we did have a Russian oligarch or an Arab sheikh or an American finance capitalist running the club and putting £1 billion into Leeds, and that's the football club, and let's say overnight that football club got into the Premier League and started doing well, people would be worried, because what would it mean for the loss of identity? Which brings me on to the second point, where you're talking about the youth and the idea that, you know, we wouldn't be playing our players from the local community. They'd have less opportunity. There'd be more foreign players coming in. You know, they'd be attracted to the lucrative side of it. So I think that's kind of held Leeds back in some ways. At the same time, you know, local pride is very important, and it's a good thing. I think there's no easy answer to this, but I can see it as a contradiction that there are these two different sides of Leeds. There's a local pride side, and occasionally there's this very aspirational, ambitious side. And I think that is a part of the contradictory narrative of Leedsness. I don't see that contradictory narrative in Liverpool. You know, this is a city which, you know, obviously gave birth to the greatest, you know, popular, musical expression of the last, you know, 50, 60 years, the Beatles. So Manchester, similarly, doesn't have this contradictory narrative. That's the first thing. Now, you talk about local communities that are also sort of divided. Now, the Asian or South Asian community has not made any headway, and this has been a tragedy for Yorkshire. It's not made any headway up until the last 10 or 15 years. You know, during the 1960s and 1970s, there was sort of immigration into this country, into places like Bradford and Leeds, and it reminded me of the immigration of my grandparents and great-grandparents at the beginning of the 20th century. And although the first generation, you know, weren't particularly involved in sport, the second generation of my background, you know, the Jewish community, and third generation, they got involved. But I think for various reasons, the second and third generations of these Asian communities have not got involved. And that's been for reasons to do with external and internal pressures. The external pressure has been, you know, let's call it as we see it, racism. There was a terrible racist problem that English football used to face back in the 70s and 80s. And although it's not gone away completely, it was mainly directed towards, you know, black players. But why do Asian players why have they not made the breakthrough in English football? I mean, this is the big question. It's not just in Leeds. And as I say, there are external reasons for this to do with, you know, just issues around discrimination and bigotry and exclusion. But internally, within the community, there's a sense I remember with my own community. Well, you know, it's not a great thing to get involved in sport because for cultural reasons, you know, it's not the most welcoming, the most open of sports. And I think that, you know, you have to address these problems openly. We have to be clear about this. There's a sort of white elephant in the room that is the sort of big elephant in the room is that there's a sort of division in these communities I've talked about earlier, places like Rotherham, places like Doncaster, Barnsley, and there's sort of elements of bigotry there, you know, in the what used to be called the host community, and those also came out in the Brexit vote, and again we can't sort of shy away from this, that we've become more, I think we've become a more racist culture in since Brexit, that there's been a permission has been given for, you know, people to use the kind of language that would be considered uncivilized and you know, not in the traditions of British values, and certainly, you know, in the last couple of years I think there's been a growth of racism, and there's been a growth of intolerance, and therefore, you know, it can't be separated from the rest of society, and very often it does reflect these kind of tensions within society.
I think that's also a very stark wake-up call in terms of what even having a black captain from South Africa like Lucas Radebe, you know, can and cannot achieve in broader social terms, right? And a lot of times football gets all this pressure put on it to accomplish these very difficult social goals, and it really isn't set up to do a heck of a lot, frankly, although there's much more that can be done for sure, as the references to the women's game that you made earlier I think speak to. We have about 15 minutes left in this intellectual pelada, this pickup game. Tarminder has a question. And then also I will ask a question, and if there's time, we can ask a final one. So over to Tarminder.
Hi, thank you. I have to apologize. I haven't read the book, but listening to the discussion so far, especially the way it started, it made me think of Ken Burns' baseball. I just finished watching the whole 9 innings, 10th remains, and it just, as we were going through, I mean, you're familiar with the Ken Burns baseball 9 inning series. It's a long documentary.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was, and as we finished, I couldn't help stop thinking that baseball represents everything that is good, bad, and ugly about American society. Mm. And from the discussion earlier, so my question more is like, throughout like the early years of baseball, players are treated so badly, fans are happy, owners are happy. Today neoliberal turn the turn from players becoming free agents, being able to negotiate better deals, at least the top players are treated really well. They are like workers with rights and very, very good pay. But again, watching that documentary, the same fan loyalties are difficult to construct. That era cannot be reconstructed. And I just wondered how that speaks to Leeds in your book. I mean, there are forces which, or there are segments which benefit, and something is gained and something is lost. And so I just thought, how does that work for Leeds of football in Britain? And
Well, you know, I think the similarities are glaring there, and that the last thing you said, something's been gained and something's been lost. You know, I think again, it's not a sort of an easy, simplistic thing to say that, you know, everything's terrible now, everything's great. I mean, just to know, to me, I wish I could make a series as brilliant as that, the baseball one, and I think the Ken Burns miniseries, it's magnificent. Because I think that Leeds, in many ways, why are we talking about Leeds? It's kind of its position in geographically. I mean, I would argue Leeds is sort of very much middle Britain. You know, it's sort of it's the place if you want to go and sort of gauge the sort of social, cultural, political, and economic temperature of Britain, I think you go to Leeds and you get all the contradictions that we're seeing at the moment in Britain, which can be expressed, in the Brexit debate. They are epitomised in Leeds. I mean, Leeds, is it's a tale of two cities. There is a more affluent part of it. There's a very deprived part of it. There are definitely two versions of Leeds. In my head, there's a version of Leeds which probably is different to the version of Leeds if the people who are born into, more deprived areas of Leeds wouldn't have. So therefore, that's what I'm trying to say is the contradictions of Leeds, the contradictions of Britain, the contradictions of, gaining and losing are there, and what has been gained, also the contradictions of football. So, for example, I was very negative earlier about how I think that modern football has been corroded by money, and I think that the disconnect between the fans, the supporters, the communities, and the elite clubs has been a tragedy. It's not just a tragedy for those clubs, but it's a tragedy for the nation. But there's been stuff that's been gained. For example, there's not the same amount of racism that there used to be. There's not the same amount of violence and brutality there used to be when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s and 80s. There's not the hooliganism. Football is safer. It's more of a family sport. It's not as male dominated, as I said earlier, than there's been the rise of the women's game. So these are contradictions that we have to come to terms with. And I think Leeds is a good way of expressing these contradictions that we see in football, in Britain. And I think, therefore, you can see Leeds as a microcosm for these tensions in society. And the history of Leeds United, to me, in many ways, is a microcosm of the history that has taken place of English football. And that in itself, speaks to a much bigger history, a social history that has, ever since the Second World War, been clear. And that's two things: the decline of manufacturing heavy industry and the rise of neoliberalism. And so if you look at America as well, the United States of America, you can see again that there's this sort of Rust Belt America and its disconnection from what it sees as the sort of liberal elite or the mainstream. That has expressed itself through sport. And it's also, of course, expressed itself through politics in the last few years. Not in a good way, in my view, but neither has Brexit been a good way of expressing it. But there's been a sense of powerlessness. And that powerlessness is absolutely there. If you go to Leeds, you can see it. You go where Elland Road, the football stadium, is in South Leeds. You go to Beeston and Hunslet, and you go to Holbeck. And that powerlessness is so clear, and it's actually on the doorstep of the football ground, and therefore it's not surprising that that powerlessness is an expressed by the fans who attend the football matches. And football has always played this social role, and baseball plays a similar role in America.
Right. Did you want to follow up, Tarminder?
No, lots to think about. Thank you.
Yes, indeed. I didn't think Ken Burns was going to pop up in our conversation. So thanks for bringing that interminable series into the conversation. It's a bit like crickets, no? These very, very long engagements that football is very different from, because we in 90 minutes we get the job done, and we are almost at that 90 minute mark. But if I could bring it to the personal dimension of the book, we've been talking a lot about broader trends and social implications and the like, and it struck me rereading the book today how your story is intertwined with Leeds in a very special way. And what I mean by this, and it relates to Nick Hornby in part, but that you were born in 1960, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Correct.
And so you are becoming a young man. You're going through childhood and your teenage years at exactly the same time that the Reedy Revolution is unfolding and that Leeds rises to the top of English football and comes within a whisker of European Cup glory. How different might the book have been if you had been born 10 years later or perhaps earlier? And the reason I ask this is because those are such formative years. I think, you know, for males in football in particular, there's something, some you know, there's an umbilical cord that gets reconnected perhaps between the age of 6 and 14 maybe. And through football, maybe it's the experience of the stadium, and it's all those other things we love about football. But how much of what we get in this wonderful book is a happy coincidence in some respects,
and
how might it have been if you had been younger or older?
Well, this is a good question. You know, if you talk to my son, who is now 17, 18, and you know, he has only known misery and suffering, that, you know, in the way he's entitled to report me, you know, to the authorities for a terrible neglect, emotional neglect by making him support Leeds United, you know, he could have picked, you know, Arsenal, Manchester United, Liverpool, but he's been saddled with a team that has only known unmitigated misery, despair, and huge suffering. And for that, I apologise to him. But at the same time, you know, it's a happy coincidence. Perhaps, let's say that you were born in the, and you were, you, sorry, your formative years were during the kind of Alec Ferguson golden age of Manchester United. You'd be going, yes, I mean, that was amazing. We, you know, Manchester United won the treble. They had Eric Cantona, who they stole from Leeds, of course, at the beginning. And then they obviously had the Beckhams and the Scholes and so on. And you could say the same of Liverpool. You know, what an amazing good fortune. What great fortune it would be to have lived through the Bill Shankly, Bob Paisley, Kenny Dalglish era. And now you could be saying, what great good fortune if you're living in Manchester, and you're living through the Pep Guardiola Manchester City golden age at the moment. You know, nearly every team really has its kind of golden age, its glory years, and you think, wow, I would have been, it would have been great to have lived through that. But, again, I have to sort of, although you brought it to the personal, and I think it is very personal to me, and I have a many sort of, what's different from the Nick Hornby thing is I don't sort of go as far as he does in looking at the personal side of it, because I'm always aware that there is a socioeconomic and cultural context. And what that is that I don't think it's a happy coincidence that I, by being born in 1960, was a beneficiary of what, you know, in Britain was a welfare state, the social democratic consensus, the social mobility, that meant that so many people who came from, you know, my dad's background and my grandparents' background would not have benefited from because they didn't have the, you know, the free education, the National Health Service, and all the great trappings of being brought up in a sort of a social democratic society. I think that that is the bigger context than just happening to be born in and grow up in Leeds during a period where we were so lucky that we had, admittedly, an amazing manager, Don Revie, because that's not the only thing that happened. As I describe in the book, it was a perfect storm. It wasn't just that we had a brilliant manager, a once-in-a-lifetime manager, Don Revie. It wasn't just that. It was the players were coming through from the youth team. I mean, Revie inherited them, some of them. The city was growing in strength and confidence. It wasn't just the football club. The rugby league club was very strong. I remember 1968, outside the Leeds Town Hall, seeing our three great clubs that were based in Leeds. Leeds United, they just won the League Cup and what was then the Fairs Cup, but it became the UEFA Cup. Two trophies. Leeds Rugby League, which had just, I think, won the league. And Yorkshire County Cricket Club, which was based in Leeds, well, Headingley is based in Leeds. And I don't know how much you know about cricket, but they had a great, perhaps the greatest cricket team. They'd won three titles in a row, and very quickly they had Boycott, Truman, Close, and I always forget the other one. But they had four amazing players. What I'm saying is, that's not a coincidence. We were all part of a generation, or maybe two generations, that had grown up in a self-confident socially, culturally, economically developing city that felt a sense of its own power. And that's part of the idea that, you know, it's Yorkshire and the North are strong. And that contrasts with the mid-70s, when you start to begin to see the decline in that, you know, consensus, that social democratic consensus. You start to see a decline economically as the oil crisis hits everywhere, but 1973-4. And then you get the gradual introduction of what I see to be neoliberal values that deregulate, privatize, and I don't want to get too political, but break up these fantastic communities. So I was lucky. The good fortune I had was being part of a community which had blossomed and, you know, felt through its football and rugby and cricket teams, felt that it could take on the world. And that's what I was lucky to be born into. But it wasn't just a Leeds thing. It wasn't just a Yorkshire thing. It was a Northern thing. And it was part of that part of Britain, industrial Britain. Little did we know, you know, what was to come, what was to follow. And so I think it's no coincidence today that there is a North-South divide in this country in football. There's a big gap. There's the moneyed elite in London where the Russian oligarchs, the Arab sheikhs, the American finance capitalists and so on go. Okay, Manchester's a bit different, but you know, we haven't time to look into that. And then most of these great northern clubs, whether in Yorkshire or the North East, Newcastle, Sunderland, Middlesbrough, and so on, and these smaller areas have been falling behind for so long that the gap is just too big. And I'll leave you with this. You know, we have these top six clubs, and we know that they'll always be the top six now. You know, so we know that Chelsea, Tottenham, Arsenal, the two Manchester clubs in Liverpool, they've got the most money, and they will stay unless they have. You know, a reduction in money, they will be the top six. Whereas when I grew up, every season, I think there were 12, 13, 14 teams that thought that they could win the league. Whereas most clubs who aren't in the top six think a good season for me would be to avoid relegation, finish fourth from bottom. Now that's not sport, that's not football. I mean, what is the point of sport? It's unfair. It's rigged. It's skewed in favour of the moneyed elite. And the biggest tragedy of all, and it's not just a Leeds thing, it's not just me personally, it's just symptomatic of this wider malaise that I think we are living through at the moment. And I hope there is a sea change, and I hope it all, you know, we move away from it. But that's what we've had to put up with in the last two or three decades.
Football by the 1% for the 1%.
Exactly. Yes. Right.
Right. Well, we would like to thank you, Anthony Clavain, for joining us in the Football Scholars Forum. It's been a great conversation, and hopefully we can get around to discussing maybe Yorkshire Tragedy or some other work. Mm. And yeah, thanks very much. And
well, thank you.
We will keep in touch. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank really you. Enjoyed it.